Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Eric Grazer. Eric is an independent geopolitical analyst. He's based in New York. He founded StopImperialism.com. I can't imagine a more important initiative than that. If there's anything that's ravaging the world led by America and its NATO complicit allies and others, it certainly is advancing America's imperialism. We've got to find a way to stop it. Eric also contributes regularly to progressive websites. He's featured often on air, and today he's featured on this program. Eric, it's great to have you on.
Thank you for having me, Stephen.
Oh, it's terrific, Eric. There's so much that you and I focus on world and national issues. Earlier in the week, we exchanged a couple of emails. You mentioned talking about what's going on in the Middle East. Let me let you jump into that. Certainly, Syria takes central stage.
Sure. I mean, the situation in Syria, I mean, it continues to evolve or devolve, perhaps would be a better way of looking at it. What we've seen, I would say, in the previous, say, 18 to 20 months or so was a sustained assault by the forces of imperialism. And let me just define what I mean by that. That would be the regional proxies of the United States. So Saudi Arabia, Qatar, to some degree, of course, Turkey as well. And then, of course, Israel. These four countries primarily, though not exclusively, working in the interests of the United States in this assault against Syria. And that's done in a number of ways, and we could go into various details of how that's happened. But what we've seen up until this point has been those forces attempting to use their proxies inside of Syria that we've come to call the rebels, though I think terrorists is a far more appropriate word for them, and attempting to use these forces to destabilize the country and to effect regime change, to topple the Assad government. And we've seen in recent months that seemingly a recognition within these imperial powers that this strategy has failed, that fighting on the ground between the Assad forces and the so-called rebels has shown that the Assad forces are winning, that they are regaining territory, that they are killing off the human capital of these terrorists. And we should point out that the vast majority of them, that is to say of the effective ones, have been imported into Syria from outside the country, places like Afghanistan, Chechnya, Saudi Arabia, Libya, and many other places have provided some of these fighters. But as I mentioned, we've seen a transitional phase, I think, in the last few months. The recognition that this destabilizing effort has failed has now transformed into a new stage, what I would call the provocation stage. And I think that the provocation stage is perhaps best exemplified by the actions of Israel. You know, we've seen these unprovoked bombings inside of Syria by Israel. For what purpose? Do they serve necessarily a strategic purpose? Do they serve even a diplomatic one? No. Rather, Israel, as it has been used many times before, is being used to provoke or to attempt to provoke a response, to ratchet up the situation such that the pretext for intervention would be self-evident. I think that it's important to note that Syria has not responded in the way that the imperialists would have liked, and so I think that's why we see this back and forth every day between the Syrian government, the Israeli government, the United States, Russia, all of the forces in this diplomatic equation interacting with each other, because the imperial strategy has failed.
It absolutely has failed, short of supplying the so-called rebels, Eric. Let's call them what they are. The Western enlisted, recruited, armed-funded, directed death squads, terrorists. I saw one report some time ago, Eric, that mentioned that they may be coming in from as many as 29 different countries, including European countries. I mean, I don't know what kind of a story these people are told to go in and fight against another Arab country. If they're Muslims, if they're Arabic, why should they be targeting Syria? What kind of a song and dance are they given? I mean, the real enemies in the region are very clear. The number one enemy is Israel. And here you've got these people in Syria on Israel's border. Why are they attacking somebody they should be allied with? Why aren't they focusing on an enemy? Of course, they shouldn't be there fighting in the first place.
Well, there's a number of reasons why. I mean, if you're asking on the ground level, that is to say, what the terrorists on the ground are told, I think that it's somewhat obvious. That is to say, that most of them are indoctrinated into the ideology that they must defend Sunni Islam, that they must defend the rights of their Sunni people, Sunni Islam, against the heretical forces of Shiism. You know, that is one of the principal propaganda tools that is used by the heads of terror networks who are, invariably allied with the United States. You know, I would just remind people that terrorism, as we understand it, is not, you know, it is not the phenomenon that is sold to us in the media. You know, one of my colleagues, Sibel Edmonds, has recently done a 6-part series exposing the second phase of Operation Gladio. And what she reveals, and this is one of the reasons why she was persecuted as a whistleblower, is the direct connection between the main players within the international terrorist network that comes to be known as Al-Qaeda and the U.S. government and U.S. intelligence, and not simply a, you know, tangential connection, but in fact a direct one. The establishment of more than 350 madrasas in Turkey and elsewhere, the establishment of an entire terrorist infrastructure since the 1980s and particularly into the 1990s and the early part of the 2000s. That is a story that is entirely missed by the media, and it goes to show how these terror networks not only were established, but how they are utilized, and it is, of course, to further the political and geopolitical agenda of the United States, or perhaps more correctly, of this transnational imperial system. And I use that phrase because I want to be as precise as possible. You know, I've been accused by a number of people in a number of different ways of, you know, being quote-unquote anti-American, and it's important that we clarify those terms. It is not America. It is the imperialism that is embodied by the ruling class in the United States, but not exclusive to the United States. And it is this imperialist ruling class that is waging war against Syria for geopolitical reasons, of course, because Syria is part of the axis of resistance. Syria has maintained an oppositional stance against Israel for decades, and perhaps most importantly, Syria is a vital and integral part of what I call the Shiite arc of dominance. That is this alliance that exists that stretches from Tehran to Baghdad to Damascus and to southern Lebanon with Hezbollah. And so the imperial strategy is to bust that arc of dominance. And in order to do that, you have to break off Syria, isolating Hezbollah, giving Israel the necessary conditions for them to engage in another war against Hezbollah, another war against Lebanon. So, to kind of sum it all up, what you see is a continuation and a perpetuation of this imperial strategy, but it is being ratcheted up. It is gaining in momentum precisely because conditions on the ground and diplomatically have changed so dramatically.
Well, they certainly have, Eric. And the other element that I stress all the time is that America especially tolerates no independent governments. So look at the governments that are vilified, either attacked or vilified. In another hemisphere, Venezuela, a strong independent country, a country with a system exactly the opposite of what Washington foists on the American people, where social benefits are being destroyed, and Venezuela cherishes them. It wants to do everything it can to share the country's resources with all the people in the country, but especially the people who are most in need. So there are wonderful benefits in Venezuela. So you got Chavez, while he was alive, demonized with all kinds of vilifications, including occasionally calling him Hitler, an astonishing way to characterize the most democratic guy in the hemisphere while he was alive. And the same thing now is going on against Maduro. But in the Middle East, you've got this connection, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Hezbollah, you've got Hamas in Gaza. I think Israel likes having Hamas around because it's a useful enemy that it can beat up on, but it doesn't really have anything to fight Israel with. You can't fight the world's fourth largest military with every conceivable powerful weapon, Eric, with homemade rockets and whatever.
Stephen, don't forget, Hamas was established by Israel.
Oh, absolutely.
I saved the article when I first, when I first found it. I think it was 2009, though it might have been 2007, Wall Street Journal, where they document meticulously the way in which Israel founded Hamas to use it as a bulwark against Palestinian nationalism, against Arab nationalism, against the PLO, and they wanted to use Hamas as a wedge, as an Islamist wedge to break apart the bloc that was developing that was Palestinian nationalism, or, from this Arab nationalist perspective. And, it's, I think, important to remember that Arab socialism and Arab nationalism is what the powers of empire have feared more than anything else. And look at who they've attacked. The main pillars of that ideology, that being Gaddafi and Assad, the two really last remaining vestiges of what used to be known as Arab socialism. And yet, who are they allied with? They're allied with Saudi Arabia, with Qatar, with Kuwait, with the United Arab Emirates, in other words, with the most undemocratic, most tyrannical and dictatorial forces perhaps in the world. And those are the same forces who seek to preach to Syria and to Libya about democracy. It is the height of hypocrisy. There is no other word for it.
Oh, absolutely. And they went after NASA in Egypt,
in Mosaddegh, in Iran, and, we could go on and on.
Oh, absolutely. Of course, 1953, the CIA's first coup, led by the grandson of Theodore Roosevelt, took him two tries, Eric, but he got rid of a democratic leader, Mohammad Mossadegh, put in the Shah for a generation. He reigned terror for all that time. He fell out of favor. He was replaced, and there's been a war, a war in various ways other than bombing and invasion against Iran ever since. It's astonishing.
Well, and what's interesting about that too, and I say this without making any value judgments about the Iranian political system, because I think that there are many things that could be said about it, positive and negative. But what we should remember is that the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran was by numbers perhaps the greatest political mobilization of anti-imperialist forces in history. To be able to unite such a vast country with such a diverse population almost unanimously against the U.S. puppet ruler and throw him out and establish their own political system, that, more than ideology or anything else, is why the United States has waged perpetual war and destabilization against Iran for the last 35 years.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the untold stories about that revolution was, I don't think America could have stopped it. I think the Iranian people were just fed up and they decided they were going to do something about it, which is the only way real change ever comes. But the Shah fell out of favor. He wanted to do things that America was not too pleased about, like developing his own nuclear commercial program was fine. That was fine, I think, with Washington. But he wanted to export it across the region. This was a no-no because it interfered with companies like GE and mm-hmm. the other U.S. companies that sell nuclear technology for commercial purposes. So that, and I think other things, he got too cozy with Russia, I think, as well. And he just fell out of favor, and he had to go. If I remember right, I think Jimmy Carter, he wanted to come to America when he took ill with cancer, and Jimmy Carter wouldn't let him in.
Right, that's right.
You don't do that to an ally for 25 years. I mean, that showed how he fell out of favor. I think the thinking was that you could bring Ayatollah Khomeini back from Paris and America could control him. Well, they guessed wrong.
I think that there was a fundamental assumption that they were making that was kind of, I think articulated best by Zbigniew Brzezinski at the time, who had always referred to Muslim fundamentalism and radical Islam as the great bulwark against Soviet communism. And the notion was that they could continue to use jihadism and radical Islam to, as in any case, place as a buffer against the Soviets. But of course, that doesn't really take into account the vast difference between the kind of fundamental Islam or conservative Islam practiced by the Iranian clerical establishment and the kind of jihadi extremism practiced by the U.S.-created al-Qaeda. Very, very different, dramatically different, which is why I always laugh every time I hear in the mainstream media them trying to pin al-Qaeda to Iran as if they're not 100% ideologically opposed to each other.
Oh, absolutely. America, of course, invented al-Qaeda, and Osama was a covert. He didn't know it. He worked through Pakistan's ISA, but he was a covert CIA asset. He wasn't an agent, but he was an asset. Of course, everybody who listens to this program knows against the Soviets in the 1980s. And al-Qaeda, today's Taliban, and other elements that showed up in Libya, in Iraq, they're fighting in Syria now. The same kind of elements, these are just latter-day people. Others were latter-day people. And the dirty game goes on and on and on. And the so-called terrorists, there's a famous picture, I'm sure you saw it, Eric, of the Taliban, al-Qaeda, in the 1980s, sitting, I guess, in the Oval Office with Ronald Reagan, where he called them the moral equivalent of our founding fathers.
That's right. And, you know, remember, too, that it wasn't just Ronald Reagan. You know, one of the, let's look at somebody who's actually engaged in government right now, Congressman Christopher Cox from Southern California. I think that's his name. He is involved in attempting to foment destruction of Iran, attempting to foment civil war in Balochistan, attempting to put through a resolution in the House of Representatives to essentially propagandize all of eastern Iran and western Pakistan. This is the same guy that we have photographs of from the 1980s on the field with Mujahideen fighters. Okay, so this is somebody who has been not only a sponsor and supporter of terrorism, he's been championing it in the halls of government. And this is somebody who is still in the U.S. government, and as we speak, trying to put through legislation to continue this destabilization of Iran. He is a supporter of the terrorist organization known as Mujahideen-e-Khalq, which carried out many, many terrorist attacks and killed many, many innocent Iranians. He is a supporter of a number of terrorist organizations, such as Jundallah, such as Lashkar-e-Taiba, all in that region, all with the bullseye on Iran. So what we see is that it's not just anti-Iranian sentiment, it is full-blown imperialism, because in the letter that he wrote to former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, he even specified that the number one motivation of the United States in that region is the destruction of Iran and the stealing of the natural resources of Balochistan, particularly oil, gas, and mineral resources. So the level of imperialist rhetoric in the United States is at such a fevered pitch that it's almost as if there has been universal recognition of the imperialist character of this country. It's almost as if we can speak of it in the open now, as opposed to the way it used to be, where it was just America's dirty secret.
Oh, it gets so much worse, Keith, over and over again. And look at the legacy of America's wars, and some that really don't get much attention, because everything Israel does, including what it does to the Palestinians, literally is a joint U.S. operation. America supplies Israel with billions of dollars every year. Just a few days ago, a U.S. ship, the USS Kearsarge, landed in Israel's most southern port, Eilat, if I'm pronouncing it right. It came with 1,800 Marines. America already has troops in Jordan along Syria's border. In an article I wrote, I asked whether these 1,800 are being deployed to supplement these troops. There are also 20 Osprey helicopters, I forget the precise name for them, but Osprey helicopters, this stuff going to Israel. At the same time, Eric, that John Kerry is traipsing around, and Obama goes along with this and others, saying, we want a peace conference to solve the issue in Syria. So Israel is being beefed up with more weapons. You got Marines, more Marines coming into the region. They're going to hold another peace conference, probably early June. It's going to be the same thing as the other stuff that went on. There was the Kofi Annan peace plan. It was a joke. It was one-sided. You had the Geneva peace conference last June, almost a year ago. The rhetoric that came out of that was wonderful, but it was meaningless. Nothing came. Nothing happened. More weapons to the so-called rebels. The fighting intensifies. I mean, this thing has no end in sight. I mean, there's no, and Obama repeats all the time, Assad must go. Assad must go. I wonder whether it's a recording and he's just mouthing his lips. I mean, he just keeps coming out over and over again. I mean, here's a guy who's a constitutional lawyer, and he certainly knows something about international law, Eric. There's no ambiguity in these laws. Every single treaty that America signs on to automatically becomes U.S. law by the supremacy clause of the Constitution, Article 8, Section something or other, maybe Article 1, Section 8, maybe it is, the supremacy clause, automatic U.S. laws. Well, the law is very clear. No nation, for any reason, can interfere in the internal affairs of another country except in self-defense if they're being attacked, or if an attack is so imminent, you've got to do something to protect yourself. And even then, you can only do it until the Security Council acts. It has final say. Well, we both know, Eric.
And Stephen, don't forget too that the precedent that was established at Nuremberg dictates that to wage an aggressive and unprovoked war is considered the supreme war crime. It is the supreme crime that any state can commit, and that is precisely what Obama has done on a number of different occasions. I mean, Libya alone is one of the most blatant war crimes, really, ever committed. There is no justification within the context of international law. What they attempt to build their justification on is this completely discredited and flimsy notion of humanitarian intervention and responsibility to protect, which we should remember is nowhere codified, actually codified in international law. What is codified in international law is the UN Charter. It is the original Geneva Charter, which specifies quite clearly that to wage unprovoked aggressive war against another state is the supreme crime. So then I would ask the obvious question, why have we not arrested Obama and the entire administration and sent them to The Hague for war crimes? Well, number one, we don't technically participate in the International Criminal Court, so that's a separate issue. But the point is that the war crimes committed by the United States are not considered war crimes. They are simply politics, whereas the war crimes committed by the enemies of the United States are held up as war crimes. It is the implicit double standard of empire, and I think that and this is kind of where we need to focus on the media. This is where the mainstream media, the controlled media in this country and in the Western powers more generally, serves its purpose and earns its paycheck, so to speak. It is to convince, to propagandize, and to convince the masses that what is going on around the world in our name are not even war crimes, that they are not crimes against humanity, that somehow this is all defensive and it's always with the best of intentions. Well, I would pose the counterpoint of, you can take your good intentions and go and tell that to the 100,000 families in Libya whose brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, mothers, and fathers are now dead, whose country is completely destroyed, whose institutions will have to be rebuilt from the ground up and are being currently built by the forces of empire. So tell that to the people of Libya. Tell that to the innocent people in Syria whose sons and daughters are being killed every day by organizations like the Al-Nusra Front. What is the Al-Nusra Front? The Al-Nusra Front is just the rebranded version of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. It streamed over the border from Iraq, reconstituted itself as Al-Nusra, and became the most potent fighting force in the country. And where did they come from? They came out of U.S. occupation, out of another U.S. imperialist war. So all of this, unfortunately, we have to be self-reflective about this. All of this comes back on us and our collective complicity in all of it.
It's the thing that just agonizes me all the time, Eric. It grates on me. When will enough people realize that the things that are going on, that our government is doing, that are being kept from us, the real truth is being kept from us, and these things touch our lives directly? What other country devotes its resources, on the one hand, to supporting corporate power to make it more powerful, and on the other hand, devoting an inordinate amount of America's resources toward raging imperial wars around the world, destroying countries, murdering people by the millions, and ignoring vital needs at home, not only ignoring them, but now on a literally jihad to destroy them, targeting Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, and other vital things that people need, everything from impoverished people in freezing places, denying them fuel oil help in wintertime, food stamps so they can feed their families, all kinds of things like this, plus stripping them of the right to get health care. In an article I just wrote, went out this morning, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, it should be called the Unaffordable Care Act, in that act, among other horrific features, 47 new laws. It nearly knocked me over when I saw this. 47 new laws that the IRS involved in its own scandal at the moment, Eric, complicit with the Obama administration. 49 new laws that they will be enforcers of. Well, I can just imagine the kind of harm that will be done to enormous numbers of people because you didn't do this and you didn't do that and this is what you have to do. It doesn't matter whether you can afford it or not. So these are the kinds of things that are going on at home, plus all kinds of police state laws. And the resources of the wealthiest country in the world are going to enrich people who don't need any more enrichment, corporations that are raping us and plundering us and destroying countries and killing millions of people. And we have the audacity to call ourselves a democracy?
Well, you know, Stephen, you also pointed, by bringing up this question of the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, I think that you're actually really kind of illustrating a very important connection that you have two seemingly different concepts that are actually intertwined. On the one hand, the raping and the pillaging of the working class and the poor in the United States, which is absolutely what austerity American style means. And on the other hand, what you mentioned, the insidious power that corporations have in this country. And I think that Obamacare in many ways represents the nexus between those two, because in fact we should remember that Obamacare is nothing if it's not a bailout for the insurance companies. Those insurance companies like Prudential and, Blue Cross and whatever else, all of these massive insurance companies, they all looked at their kissing cousins on Wall Street and said, how come they get a bailout and we don't? We're underwater too. We're insolvent too. We've been playing the derivatives games too. We need a bailout. So here's your bailout. We're going to legislate and mandate that people buy private health insurance. Not that the government will provide single payer Medicare for all, which is the rational and practical policy suggestion. No, we will mandate that you buy private insurance from these corporations so that you can line their pockets, and we're going to get lobbyists from those corporations into government to write the legislation to make sure that whatever loopholes are put in there, whatever legislation actually is passed, will only benefit those same corporations. So when you're talking about the corporate control of this imperial system, it translates into what we're seeing in the form of austerity. And I would also just I would remind people that, you know, although I don't necessarily politically agree in many ways with Lenin and with the Bolshevik Revolution, I don't agree entirely, but the point that Lenin made was absolutely accurate about imperialism, that he explained quite clearly and quite brilliantly that imperialism is the highest stage of capitalism, that when capitalism evolves to the point that it has evolved in the United States and in the Western world, that it must by its very nature turn become imperialist, because resources and land and markets are the only thing that will maintain the system. So the capitalist, the neoliberal capitalist, free trade, et cetera, all of this economic system that we're living under is in many ways the driving force or the manifestation of this imperial character of this country that we still call the United States.
Oh, I agree absolutely, Eric. I mean, the very nature of capitalism is it needs to grow. You have public corporations, they're beholden to shareholders, they want a return on their equity, and the only way they can get it is for profits to grow, for revenues to grow. So, you know, America is one place in one part of the world. There's a whole big world out there. You got to exploit all of it. We need to take a break, Eric. Let's hold these thoughts. We'll take a short break, and we'll come right back. Talking with Eric Grazer, going around the world, the Middle East, other countries, talking about what's going on in America. One of the big issues for you and me, Eric, is the notion of austerity when people are really in dire need of help, but they're not getting it. I'll make one comment and let you jump into it. It's a big topic for me, and you've certainly spent time on it. Early in Obama's first term, I wrote an article comparing, I think it was mostly Roosevelt's first 100 days versus Obama's first few months in office. Roosevelt really didn't get going in full steam until a couple of years into his first term. But what he did, he was a patrician. He was a conservative. But he finally realized, and I think there were some enlightened corporations around that time, that it was better to give a little bit than risk capitalism being destroyed, because the echoes of the Russian Revolution was still audible while the so-called evil empire is gone. But we got Social Security, we got real labor rights, the Wagner Act, I believe it was, that gave organized labor the right to bargain on a level playing field, reasonably so, with management. Well, that's all gone now. We got many other things. We got people helped to stay in their homes. Now they're literally being rousted out, and their homes are being foreclosed on by God knows how many numbers, huge numbers, and it keeps going. So both administrations were absolutely polar opposite, and the need now is just horrific. Absolutely horrific. There's a new article on global research that more people are committing suicide now than back in the Great Depression. In the Great Depression, people got help. In the second Great Depression, people are being denied help increasingly.
Yeah, and I think that there's probably a number of reasons for something like the jump in suicide rates. Remember that, yes, the economic depression of the 1930s was horrific, and many people's lives were utterly destroyed. But in the current situation, if you were to compare it, you didn't have millions of people in the United States overly medicated on antidepressants that often oftentimes drive them to suicide. You didn't have people who were, being thrown out of their homes in the way that you have in the United States today. And you pointed to the fact that you characterized Roosevelt and Obama as polar opposites, and I would agree insofar as the diametrical opposition between the two, I think, is rooted in their relationship to finance capital. You know, you're correct that Roosevelt was, you know, from the upper crust. He was from, you know, they didn't use the term at the time, but, you know, the 1%, so to speak. However, he recognized that in order for him to be a real leader in this country, given the circumstances that he inherited, that he must be in opposition to finance capital. He, you know, famously said that he welcomed the hate of the financiers. I believe he said that at his, at one of the conventions here in Madison Square Garden in New York City. And what that illustrates is that Roosevelt understood that it was finance capital and the power of finance capital, and not exclusively finance capital, of course, but primarily, that was driving this very destructive strain that existed in the United States. And, you know, you pointed to the fear of, you know, 1917 Russia, and I agree with you up to a point, but I think that that was really a very much a secondary fear for Roosevelt. I think his primary fear was the fundamentally fascist strain and undercurrent that existed in the United States that was typified by Wall Street and the financial ruling class. Remember that it was Brown Brothers Harriman and Prescott Bush and all the rest of these characters who made sure that they created the conditions for Hitler to rise in Germany. They were the unabashed supporters of Mussolini. They were the Nazis. They were the fascists, and they were the ones who were calling for Roosevelt's head, from the very day that he was elected. So, in recognizing this historical parallel, I think that we should also recognize the historical circumstances that shaped this understanding, and we see the very same thing happening today. You know, you want to look at a fascist leader that Obama fawns over, that the administration fawns over, look no further than Netanyahu in Israel, because I think that Netanyahu is in many ways one of the best, most clear embodiments of fascism that we see anywhere in the world in the 21st century. And Obama, you know, whatever his personal take on Netanyahu is, from the official perspective, Obama still stands shoulder to shoulder.
Well, there's no question about that, and I have called Netanyahu a fascist many, many times, Eric, and the government that Israelis elected, a coalition government. There has never been a single party in Israel's history. It's a short history, 1948 to the present, but there's never been one party that got a majority. It's astonishing. Never one party that got a majority vote, so there's always a coalition government, and Netanyahu, his party, the Likud, won about 25% of the vote in January, so he's a with other. I mean, there's no moderate party in Israel except a couple of minor ones that really don't matter at all. Well, there are many parties, including Arab parties, but, you know, they get a few votes here.
But the reason there. But the reason for that, I think, and I don't want to speak too much on Israeli internal politics because I'm not an expert on that, and I'll readily admit that, but the reason for what you're describing, this phenomenon, I think is important because all of the major mainstream parties in Israel recognize that its current political formation, what we know of as modern state of Israel, is 100% dependent upon the United States and upon the imperial system and upon being the golden boy of that imperial system. So for no matter what cosmetic or superficial differences might exist, those in the ruling class in Israel will never challenge the fundamental paradigm that exists, which is why none of them are able to actually speak about the human rights situation of the Palestinians, about the egregious war crimes committed by their government in Lebanon and Gaza. Gaza, in the West Bank, and elsewhere. And they're not able to speak to that because it is literally outside of their political calculus.
Well, that is very true. And given the way America is governed at home and abroad, Eric, it's no surprise that these two countries should be such close allies. Noam Chomsky, years ago, back in the days of, past the days of the Shah, but he referred to countries like Iraq under the Shah, Iran under the Shah, Turkey, and Israel as America's cops on the beat. In other words, countries that were allied with the American system so America could exploit the region for its riches, which of course are mainly oil and gas. And Israel is a very important component, which is why both countries are allied in most everything that either one of them does, including outside the Middle East. Israel has been involved against the FARC in Colombia. They've involved in other countries. I think they were involved in Central America. So they get involved with America in lots of places.
And don't forget Israel's crucial role that they played in the carving up of Sudan and the formation of South Sudan.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, these people are experts in what they do. They're a major weapons supporter, exporter. They're a technologically a very, very strong country. So they have a very, very advanced technology in a number of things, especially related to security. So again, this all plays together into the imperial system. And that imperial system is just, it's on a roll, it's on a rage. At some point, Eric, I think it all has to come apart, but I wonder whether humanity can survive the onslaught.
Well, I think that you're right, and I think you're right to characterize it in that way. And, you know, empires do always and invariably come apart. The question is it a slow unraveling or a rapid collapse? And I think that what we're witnessing right now and what we're all living through, I would call a very slow and methodical unraveling. You know, I don't really like to side with those who are the prophets of doom at all times, you know, saying that America will collapse in the next 6 months or the next year or the next 10 years. Systems of this nature and of this complexity don't just blow up overnight. You know, even something like the Soviet Union, which, you know, on the surface would seem that it collapsed overnight, had actually unraveled over the course of the previous 2 to 3 decades. So what we're seeing is this unraveling. The fear, though, the danger is that the forces of capital and the imperialist ruling class, what actions they might take to prevent the eventual unraveling of their system. And those types of actions are what create World War I, World War II, and other global catastrophes. You know, we should remember that World War I, to a large extent, and World War II, for that matter, are very much, at least to a large degree, because of the actions of the British Empire, because of the strategy of the British to play country against country, empire against empire, in the hopes of maintaining their own collapsing empire, which even up until 1912, 13, and 14, the economy was collapsing or unraveling, the empire was shrinking, and the British needed a way to maintain their imperial system. And World War I, though perhaps not consciously their plan, was the end result. World War II, in many ways, was simply just a continuation of World War I, and that political status quo that had been created by the British and their partners in the United States. So if we use that as a parallel, that is, I think, where the danger lies, because if the imperialist ruling class of the United States and the Western powers today were to follow that same model, it does seem that they are following that model, because the imperialist aggression against Syria is really to be understood as a prelude to an aggression against Iran, which in many ways really is a prelude to an aggression against Russia and or China, in whatever form that may take. And once you take it to that logical extreme, you're talking about world war, and a world war that could mean the end of humanity as we know it.
It absolutely could, Eric. I think in for a good number of years in the run-up to World War I, and my dad was in World War I in France. Luckily, he came back, or you and I wouldn't be on the phone together. he did come back long. He never talked about it for some reason. He was a one piece, so I don't know. I don't know what he saw. He wouldn't discuss it. I had relatives in World War II. I was too young. They all came back. Amazing. Not a single casualty in my family in either war. But in the run up to the First World War, Germany and Britain were great rivals, and Germany was gaining on Britain. So that really incensed the British, the notion of the British Empire. Well, it unraveled after the war. And there was the rivalry leading up to World War II, but as you say, World War II was really just a continuation of World War I. And the Western powers, including Britain, helped install Hitler. The bankers
That's right.
in London and the bankers in Wall Street, they helped put this guy in power. He never won a majority. You had von Hindenburg, the famous general from World War I. He was a national hero, but he was an old man. He was fading. And who was the guy, von Papen, who was, what was he, a prime minister? I forget. But he's the one who I think appointed Hitler, maybe in desperation. What else can I do? And I think Hindenburg was too old, and he was just way past it and maybe out of it. So he went along, and as soon as you gave Hitler an inch, he grabbed it all, and that's what happened.
But you see, and what you're pointing to is correct, and it's precisely what I was mentioning. The fact that fascism is always intertwined and dependent upon finance capital and upon corporate power. Hitler and the Nazi movement could not possibly have existed were it not for the financial support of, you know, Thyssen and IG Farben and the corporations inside of Germany who were directly connected to Brown Brothers Harriman and finance capitalists on Wall Street, not to mention, of course, Ford, who was a raging fascist, and many others as well. And you had that ruling class on Wall Street, the ruling class in London, all of whom unanimously agreed Mussolini and Hitler are the best thing to come around in the last 100 years. That's what we need to support, and we need to support that against the march of socialism and communism. And that is, to a large extent, the climate that was created, the conditions created for those world wars. So once again, we can trace it directly back to this ideology that is embedded within capitalism.
Indeed so. It shows what a destructive system capitalism is, Eric. I think of capitalism as, I put an adjective in front of it. I call it predatory capitalism. Eric, I was a capitalist. I was part of a small family business. I mean, it was a pushcart compared to the big boys. We didn't go around thinking, who can we beat up on? Who can we steal from today? We felt that it was good business to provide a good service. You do something for people, they reward you by wanting to do business with you. We thought our employees deserved to be taken care of. We had a very cyclical business where we went through recessions, and we went through a few of them. They were very, very rocky. Instead of keeping our salaries and big bonuses, we took nothing. We took ourselves off salaries. We tried to keep as many of our people on payroll as possible. We didn't cut anybody's pay. If we had to let some people go, it was the smallest number possible. But we were the ones that took the pain first, because we wanted to be good to the people who devoted their lives to working with us, and we were small, so we really were as much a family as we were a business, and we thought this was a responsible way to act. Well, I see nothing wrong with a system like that, but of course the system with the big corporations and the Wall Street interests and the complicity with big government, it's an entirely different system. So you need to call it predatory, and it is indeed destructive. And if there isn't a way to stop this thing, it's going to destroy us, Eric.
I hear what you're saying. I would disagree with you a little bit on the characterization of it, because you're right. Everything you said about your family business and, you know, and the way that you treated people and all of that, and I of course believe every word that you said. However, you would have known even at that time that system that you're talking about was entirely beholden to the power of forces well beyond you, well above you, who did not have to play by those same rules. So there is an implicit inequality, an implicit disparity within the capitalist system between those who, you know, maybe we could call
call the small-time capitalists versus, you know, the powerful corporations, but it will always be those powerful corporations within the framework of modern capitalism as we understand it. Those forces will always dominate, control, and coerce the economic system. Remember that capitalism is simply a way of organizing production, as is socialism. It is simply a way of organizing production. It is not inherently a political system. So the question becomes, who should own the means of production? Should it be wealthy capitalists on the private level, or should it be the people? Now, I'm not suggesting that socialism is a cure-all. Socialism has many fundamental flaws within it as well. But since we live where we live in this, within this imperial capitalist system, I personally feel it incumbent upon myself to call out, to call attention to these fundamental inequalities. I'm not, you know, I'm not suggesting that, you know, we should ideologically align ourselves 100% with any economic system, but we pull from Marx or from Lenin or from George Orwell or from whomever this fundamental understanding that capitalism within this manifestation that we know it today is fundamentally unequal, it is fundamentally exploitative, and it is fundamentally oppressive. And more to the point, capitalism is oftentimes, as we see today, indistinguishable from imperialism.
Well, I agree with you, Eric, and I'll give you one more point as well. But first, I would say it is absolutely impossible for capitalism as we know it and democracy to coexist. It's fire and ice. They cannot coexist. And one more thing for you, Eric. The companies that kept us in business were these big corporations. They were our best clients, so we needed them. Although most of the people we dealt with in these companies were mid or lower level people, it was very unusual for a top executive to show up. They did once in a while for various reasons. Maybe somebody was in town. Maybe they wanted to see who are these people we're writing checks to. So they came by, and I can remember getting together with a CEO of a company or two or three. They were just checking us out face to face, but they didn't actually participate directly in what we did. They had lower level people that did this, including mid-level people, but these were the people that kept us alive and made a business for us. Without them, we might not have had a business. So I absolutely go along with you on that. And the other point that I made was, it's impossible for democracy and the capitalism as we know it to coexist. It simply can't happen.
Yeah, and democracy as we understand it is in many ways a mirage, because democracy, quote unquote democracy, this is such a loaded term, and in many ways what we understand as democracy is filtered through a dominant paradigm. And you know, I hate to keep harping on the same words over and over again, but it is through the dominant capitalist imperial paradigm, where what we do is democracy, what others do is dictatorship. No matter how many elections Chavez won, Chavez was a dictator. No matter how many Jamahiriya councils were held in Libya, Gaddafi was a dictator. Never mind the fact that Libya was in many ways far more democratic than the United States, with local direct democracy and people able to make decisions that affected them and so forth. So democracy as we understand it is entirely dependent upon an imperialist worldview, and that is what needs to be fundamentally altered if we're to have any chance of restoring what we used to think of as democracy.
America never had a democracy, unfortunately, Eric. I've written plenty about that. But
I agree.
Certainly, it wasn't designed to be a democracy. I have written about that, and it's true.
And I agree with you, Stephen.
The Founding Fathers set up a system that would benefit us. Most of the people in America back in those days had virtually no rights. I mean, women couldn't vote. Black people, they weren't people. They were property and so on and so forth.
And remember, you're absolutely right, Stephen, and if I misspoke, you're correct in pointing me out on that. And we should also remember that those fundamental inequalities and injustices and exploitation were in many ways built in to the Constitution that we think of as this glorious document, which in many ways it is. You know, I often talk about the Obama administration administration or the Bush administration trampling all over the Constitution, which they do. But it's important that we also remember what you're pointing out, that the Constitution itself and the institutions and foundations of this country were founded upon exploitation and oppression. You know, when you get into a debate about the Second Amendment, for example, with people, no matter what side of the debate you're on, invariably what gets left out of the narrative is the fundamental fact that the Second Amendment was, to a large extent, included in the Constitution for the purposes of expansion. It was to make sure that white working class and peasants could be armed and could use those white peasants against the indigenous people, so that the ruling class that owned the plantations wouldn't have to contend with an armed uprising from their indentured servants.
Absolutely. It had nothing to do with the right for people today to own semi-automatic weapons and the rest of them, and to go around doing, you know, packing heat and doing the rest of it. The Second Amendment is so terribly misinterpreted. I'm on the side of the people, Eric. I'm on the side of all the people. And when it comes to naming a system that's equitable and just, there are flaws in all the systems with names.
Stephen, I'm sorry. If I could just say for the record, though, what I just said about the Second Amendment should not be understood as me opposing the Second Amendment or supporting gun control legislation as it's understood in America today, because I do not support that. I just want to say for the record, I do not support what is called gun control in the U.S.
Oh, I agree with you. I agree with you. You do one thing, and it leads to others and others and others, and to let the people that are literally terrorizing us have even greater free reign than they have
today. That's right. It's a monopoly of force to the state. It's a monopoly of force to the state, and that can't be allowed, no matter whether you're coming from the extreme right, the extreme left, or anywhere in between. When the state monopolizes force, everybody loses.
Everybody loses. I hate to agree with the gun lobby on anything.
That's right. That's right.
Eric, we are out of time. It was a great hour. I look forward to having you back. There's so much more we could have discussed. There was a lot on my mind, but I just didn't get a chance to bring it up. But we'll do it again, and we'll get into lots of stuff.
I'd be happy to come back.
Join us again tomorrow, same time, 1 p.m. Eastern. Make it a regular habit.